Campus FM presents Treasures from Malta. This episode was originally recorded for the Treasures from Malta podcast series produced by Fondazione Patrimonio Malti. Hello and welcome to Treasures from Malta, a podcast series produced by Fondazione Patrimonio Malti. I am Francesca Balzan, an art historian and an artist with a long connection with Patrimonio. I'll be presenting this podcast and meeting some of Malta's living treasures. These treasures are artists, historians or art collectors with some Malta connection. They're all fair game for the pod and we want to share them with you. Hi everyone. Today I'm all smiles as I chat with someone who has featured in my professional life as an art historian from my very earliest days at university as an undergrad. He is often the first port of call when one sets out to research an art historical topic, and visits to his museum last, on average, a good morning. You walk in with a very clearly defined research question. You walk out several hours later with your head brimming with art, having talked about absolutely everything, from high art to naive paintings, from lace to wondrous curiosities, only to discover that you actually forgot to ask that one question that you had set out to ask. Talk about falling down a rabbit hole, or several. It is my great pleasure to introduce art collector and treasured friend, Marcus De Piro.
Hello.
Nicholas, you are a member of the Maltese nobility and the founder of the beautiful Casa Rocca Piccola House Museum in Valletta. You have opened your home to the public to share with us the many decades of shrewd art collecting. You are years ahead in recognizing and appreciating various decorative art forms and also unfashionable pieces of art well before others jumped onto the bandwagon. You have been instrumental in the revival of the art of lace making by creating a competition for contemporary makers, while collecting the very finest pieces of Maltese lace and historic costume to survive. You are a founder member of Fondazione Patrimonio Malti and have helped curate major patrimonio exhibitions, and you've sourced important artifacts for these exhibitions. You have authored several publications which have become standard texts for art historians, such as the first and the entirely revised and expanded second edition of the International Dictionary of Artists Who Painted Malta. You are somewhat of a creative yourself, penning novels and poetry which evoke nostalgia for the Malta of yesteryear. Nicholas, when did you start collecting art?
My father used to say that I was the member of the family who liked junk. I was always tinkering around. There was, in those old days, when some great aunt or great grandmother died, they used to go and they used to look at her bits and pieces. My father wasn't the least bit interested. My mother, not too bad. My mother had a bit of a sense of this sort of thing. My father liked, you know, machinery and cars and things like that and mechanics. But I tended to like some of these things, and I was fascinated by drawing from a very early day, although I'm not an artist who draws. But I suppose I'm very much sort of self-taught, really, but I did allow myself to be taught by visiting so many places and museums and one thing and another. Yes, I think it's been more from the point of view of a hobby. Mm-hmm. It's something I really liked. It's something I like assessment. And I've had some wonderful criticism in the past. I remember when I was in the poetry club at Cheltenham, which was a very proper, had a lot of very clever people there. And one of them told me, "Nicholas, I like your poetry, but your adjectives are very weak." And that's the sort of criticism which you don't get very easily. I was so pleased to be told that when I thought about it. And so I'm very careful with my adjectives now.
Have they improved?
I hope so.
We'll hear some poetry later. How did you get into house museum management?
Well, I was in England in the 70s, and I was getting away from a sort of rather a lot of turmoil here. We had been involved with an estate agency with somebody called Howard Minter, and the license had gone, and things were falling apart in a way in our family. And I went away for a week, and I was walking down a street in the West End when I met an old family friend, a naval commander who lived in Gloucestershire. And he said, "Nicholas, come on, cheer up. Come and spend the weekend. We'll drink lots of brandy." And that sounded good. So I went to Gloucestershire, and by the end of the weekend, he had introduced me to the lady of the manor who owned the whole village. And she said, "Come on, I've got a lovely little place. It's not expensive. Why don't you rent it for a bit? It'll, and bring your family. It'll cheer them up." And so I rented a little folly for very little money, I remember. And my wife came over with two little children, and I planned to stay there for a month or two. And, you know, a year later, I was still there. And in the second year, the lady of the manor told me, "I've got a larger house. I won't put your rent up, but I want someone to live in it." And then, while in the larger house, I started, for pocket money, to try to find Maltese pictures. And there were so many in England, ex-naval people who had died maybe and given them to their children or grandchildren who wanted to then buy something else. And I started finding things and sent quite a lot to Malta. And then one day I went to an auction sale in a place called Painswick, which was a few miles away. It was a Palladian house, grade one, quite beautiful, in the middle of fields, and they were selling everything. And one of the dealers there told me, "The owner of this place only values the house for the land it covers. Why don't you try and get it?" And I said, "What are you talking about? There are 56 rooms in this house, and terrifying, as if I could cope. I'm not rich." And they said, "Come on, go and talk to him, see what happens." And I did nothing about it for about a week. And then I bumped into a lawyer, and I was telling him the story. And he said, "You leave this one to me. I'm going to have a word with him, whether you like it or not." And to cut a long story short, in a few days I had signed on the dotted line, and I had taken over a grade one Palladian palace for £100 a year for 20 years.
What was the state it was in?
It wasn't very good, the state, because nobody had done much to it. It did have Chinese wallpaper in one of the rooms from the 18th century, which was in reasonably good condition, and they weren't allowed to sell it because it was of national importance. Mm-hmm. It had the wooden floors, the parquets, they were all right. Well, it wasn't too bad, but the electricity was all wrong. Mm.
The roofing was fine
as
well?
It had some very high ceilings, and it was... you know, we moved in, and members of my family sort of thought I was quite crazy, but I was young enough then to cope, and we worked on it. I used to invite people for the weekend, and we used to camp in the house, and slowly we started decorating one room, and then another one, and people started admiring it, because it was a beautiful house.
So you bought in the collection, or was there an extant collection?
From here and from there, I collected and brought in and put things, rather than trying to deal. Mm-hmm. And 2 years later, there was a big fair next to the house in a field not far away. It was the Painswick Fair. And I said, "I'm going to open the house and show it to the public." We showed them the main rooms downstairs. And... the children all dressed up, the lawns were mown. I hired a band, a La Maltia. Mm. It was called the Chalfont Silver Band. It played umpa. There were 50 members, and it cost me £50, £1 each. And at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, they struck on the lawn the first notes, and it was unbelievable. 900 people came to the house that afternoon. We nearly went crazy, but I had made £300 net, and it was a start. And then the people came from the Historic Houses Association and gave me a hand. They said, "Come on, you know, it's worth doing. The house is worth it. It's a very historic house." And that's how it all started. And that after 10 years, we were ticking along, surviving, and my landlord turned up and said, I'd like to have the house back. And I said, look, I've renewed all the electricity, I've renewed part of the lead on the roof. I said, I can't give it up now. I said, I won't be a sitting tenant, you'll have it back in 10 years' time. He said, can't we possibly tempt you, because we'd like it very much. His wife had left him, and he'd got another one. And she wanted him back in the big family house, but it was empty virtually for them, because the furnishings I had put together. So anyway, eventually, after a bit of a quarrel, and we settled it, and we did a deal. And he helped me buying some of the things, and he also helped me financially with sorting out leaving. And I came to Malta, and it was a time when my mother said she found it difficult to cope with Casa Rocca, and you know, I seemed to be in line for it, and she said, why don't you take over?
So Casa Rocca was the family seat?
In a way, it was my grandfather's house. My parents had lived in it for a bit after he died. The real family seat was in Archbishop Street, in fact. But that was sold off for, you know, the family faced death duties and God knows what, and lost the National Bank shares and that one thing. And anyway, it was an interesting challenge for me, and I knew what I was doing, I thought. And so we started Casa Rocca Piccola. And people started coming, and it started working. And it hasn't been easy, but these places need subsidies, because you have to treat them very carefully. And so it wasn't really just making money, it was a question of survival. I felt Casa Rocca represents the aspirations of Maltese people, the pretensions, our taste, what we like. There's some works of art and there's some bric-a-brac. It isn't all unique things, but they're there. The furniture, quite a lot of it was made by local artisans. And I explained to visitors, I said, Malta has an abundance of sophistication. Don't forget, in the days of the knights, there were 8 languages of knights. And these were not people prepared to do anything mediocre. So our architecture was good, our silver was fabulous, our pictures had great artists, and I show off Malta and Maltese aspiration in Casa Rocca, even today.
But you also got involved in Patrimonio. When Fondazione Patrimonio Malti was set up in 1991, you actually got involved in it as a founder member. How did that come about?
Well, I was very fond of Maurice De Giorgio, and I think he quite liked me too. And he told me...
He was our chairman, our founding chairman.
He told me, the Prime Minister, was going to Japan or somewhere, and he said, they know nothing about Malta really there. He said, why don't we put together a container and put some really nice Maltese things in it and help me to choose them, and we'll set up a little exhibition in Japan so the local people will see what Malta looks like and what it's about. And I thought this was great fun. And from there, I was chit-chatting, and there was something going on at the Imdina Museum, the Cathedral Museum, something to do with sedan chairs. Mm-hmm. And I said, I think I know where there are a couple. And he said, so do I. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, our first exhibition was the sedan chairs. We put it all together. These exhibitions were so exceptional, and people so much enjoyed them without having to be professors. Look how fun, look how nice, mm-hmm. You know. And they were sort of focused. We found them in attics, and, you know, in some of the... And we put together about 20, I think it was. And then Maurice formed the committee. It got going anyway, which was exciting. And then we became ambitious, and we put on some very grand exhibitions. Later we would be putting on silver. I remember it was tiny.
Splendid.
People couldn't believe it.
Splendid. The Grand Master's table all laid out, yes, with silver was something that is tattooed on my brain, I think.
Yes.
I mean, everybody mentions
that. I remember an ambassador, I think it was from Holland or somewhere. He said, of course, this isn't Malta silver. I said, you don't realize Malta was probably one of the most sophisticated places in Europe. I said, we had 8 nationalities here. We had the 8 longs of the order. Everybody was smart and they knew exactly what was good. Why do you think our laces is among the best in the world? He said, you're talking to me. He said, I'm Flemish. I said, well, there you go. We got the best of you and the best of all the others.
Nicholas, you've been collecting for many, many years, but can you recall any particularly amazing discoveries that you were able to acquire?
This is a very frightening question. My mind's boggling.
I bet there were several, actually.
I'm trying to think. Yes, I have been very lucky, perhaps, in occasionally recognizing something which was perhaps not considered absolutely to be so wonderful. Remember, living in the 50s, I was young. I remember one of my first option sales was Mrs. Lawson's, and she was at St. Vernier before she married, and she had a lovely house in St. John Street. It was all being sold up, and the Seicento was out of fashion, not in Malta, everywhere. You know, there are terrific stories about Caravaggio's going cheap in England, you know what I mean? One person, a wonderful story recounted, was in competition there was this Caravaggio selling, and the one who bought it had actually said he bought it because of the frame. You know, incredible stories. So there were things from that period. You could buy a Gianni for £20, you know, and the museum was thinking at the time, you know, those aren't really good for us. Mm-hmm. And there were very important pictures still around, and old families who died off and didn't want to continue with Palazzi sold their lovely pictures. And yes, and I did pick up one or two early pieces. Mm-hmm. I didn't buy a Caravaggio, but I was lucky with Favre,
Zara,
Zara, yes, mm-hmm. and of course, then you always got, you know, big discussions where they went. They was it signed? Wasn't it signed? Mm-hmm. It was so exciting. I loved it all, mm-hmm. and I got very much involved in the sort of feeling for works of art. Mm-hmm. And furniture was very lovely, bureaus you could buy. You know, you could buy a lovely Maltese bureau maybe for, you know, £100 or something, and suddenly it's gone into the thousands. But I didn't want to do it as a dealer in any way.
Sure.
I wanted to put together mm-hmm. collections. Mm-hmm. And as the years passed, I went into lace a little bit. I never learned how to make lace, nor do I want to, but I can appreciate, I think, what's good. And when you get hold of a skirt that you know took 10,000 hours to make,
incredible.
You know, it cannot be ever made again. Because if you pay a person €5 an hour for 10,000 times, it's quite a lot of euros. So nobody's going to make it again. And, you know, the interest is there. And mm-hmm. I was lucky to be able to treat it as a hobby. And then over the years, I started taking an interest in what perhaps some curators hadn't taken an interest mm-hmm. in. Like naive art. There are treasures of naive art. Why are they treasures? Not because they're well painted, mm-hmm. but because the artist maybe wasn't a great artist. He's trying to prove himself. Maybe the person who commissioned the picture didn't feel like paying too much. And there you have something very detailed. Mm-hmm. The jewelry about which you know so much sometimes gets more detailed in naive art than it does in more sophisticated art.
Definitely.
I once bought a Salvador Dali, I remember, in an auction sale in England for very little money because I was lucky.
Was it a painting or a
letter? It was a watercolor drawing sort of thing, and it had Viva Picasso written on it. Heaven knows what it must be worth today. I very stupidly sold it when I was trying to educate my children. I bought it for very little and got quite a good sum, but it's worth about 100 times more now, and so on. A lot of sorts, but I don't regret any of it. Mm-hmm. And I also am very happy to feel I have embellished some other people's collections
exactly.
by sending things while I was living in England back to Malta. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. What about silverware? Did you make any discoveries there?
Yes. One day I went all the way to, I was given a ticket to go to the United States. I was from a person who was a collector and said, there's some Maltese silver going. Will you go and bid for me? And I said, yes, I would love to. And that brought a few things back. There was a lovely soup tureen, which actually was Sicilian, but it had been in Maltese probably since it was made, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And it was the pair to another one that was already in Malta. So there were coffee pots always turning up. And yes, I mean, silver was, you know, something which people liked perhaps even more than they do now. Mm-hmm. There's something about silver now. I'm noticing in the younger generation, not so keen, but yeah. My generation and my parents' generation mm-hmm. were keen on silver.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Paintings, yes, of course you found paintings connected with Malta mm-hmm. in England, and especially in England.
Schronces.
Yes, and Schronces galore, and Giannis, and
Caruana yes. Dingley, Edward Caruana Dingley.
Yes,
well.
Yeah. I bought a beautiful Edward Caruana Dingley in Scotland once.
Really?
A wonderful scene. It was a sort of village scene, you know. And one of the Malta collectors turned up one day. I wanted it so badly, I sold it. And I'm sorry I did, but anyway, there it is.
But Casarocca is so stuffed with artifacts.
I did keep something. So Casarocca's reasonably well filled up,
it's
I think.
Bursting at the seams. Have you ever acquired an artifact and then only came to realize its historic worth later on?
Yes. I'm thinking of a seal. There it was. It was among other bits and pieces that I had picked up. And one day, Vanni Bonello did an article about a state seal he found of the English period. And I said, let me go and have a look at my seals. I've got them in a drawer somewhere. And I was looking around, and I actually was surprised myself. I'd forgotten it. Maybe I'd never looked at it properly. But it seems to have been the state seal for Malta of the days of the knights. And it's there. It needs further study. But it is the most exciting, one of the most exciting objects at Casarocca.
Amazing.
And it needs to have a bit of publicity because it isn't even mentioned in the brochures.
Amazing.
I once found, tucked away, unused, uncared for, on a shelf, there was leather on one of them, and it's the sort of thing you practically might have expected a sacristan to come around with if he was collecting money during Mass. A long tube of leather with some wonderful damask at the top showing off. And there were two of these, and there was one which looked... In fact, we found out it's the thing you put behind the saddle of a horse with beautiful silver embroidery. But these other two items I mentioned, what on earth were they? And when I found out, I could hardly believe. They were attached to your saddle,
mm-hmm.
and you kept your pistols in them.
How did you find out?
Pistole. And they are so rare. And a little bit later, when we knew what they were, I had a group of Italian specialists. They ran museums and things, and they were looking at them. And I said, you know what they are? And nobody knew except for one girl from Sicily. She said, we've got some, and we know what they were. Suddenly, I started looking at portraits in a different way. When you see the king, and we've got one portrait by Favre in the fine arts here, of the king of Spain, the king of the Sicilies, and you take a good look at his saddle, and you see that on the side, he's got the item which will hold his pistol. Those, I think, are perhaps the only two that exist in Malta from the days of the knights, from early days of the knights, and there they are sitting at Casarocca, but they're not on show. We've got to mention at some stage costume.
We have
a lot of costume, and it's not only because we've been so clever to have saved them. I can't say that. People have given us things. Nobody knows what to do with a dress in a drawer, or as, you know, they say, well, we need the drawer sort of thing. And slowly, slowly, I started taking an interest. Patrimonio, of course, put on the most wonderful exhibition, and we started collecting. And, you know, dresses and one thing and another started coming in, wedding dresses started coming in. Sometimes they used to dye the wedding dress after the wedding, and then they could wear it as an evening dress, but I don't think they do that much more. And the interest came along, and we started finding some curiosities, especially in the field of underwear, which I think would cause an extremely interesting exhibition, which would a lot of people would want to come to for the wrong reasons.
Queues round the block. Is it time to have a costume museum in Malta?
It is absolute time. It is our identity. We have our own identity in costume, and we have treasures, even if they are not just our identity. But we remember we had the eight languages, we had sophistication, we had class, and we had the farming community. We had their clothes as well. Mm-hmm. Some of wonderful weave has survived. We've proved it through an exhibition of costume, which you know all about.
Patrimonio put on some years ago.
It surprised the people who organized it. It was so stunning. And, you know, among the things, we found some items in some houses which were eventually interpreted as being of incredible value, too. A French overdress, mm-hmm. which you probably know about. We had exhibited the wrong way around, but it was an overdress. But anyway, it's been studied, and it's proved to be, I can't remember if it's the Victoria and Albert or the Louvre, haven't got one.
A unique survival from the past, only yes. known presumably yes. in paintings and depictions.
Yes, I know there's one in America, mm-hmm. and I think there is one in Europe or something, but they are in. We've got one in Malta, we should show it off.
It's amazing. The Casa Rocca Piccola collection for me is an incredible treasure trove. For me, it's an Aladdin's cave, which has everything, from jewelry to antique furniture, fine paintings, silverware, those incredible chess sets, but so many things. And, of course, historic family pieces. Now, I've visited countless times, and I always leave feeling enriched, and I feel that I've spotted things that I hadn't noticed before, and I always leave feeling I've learned a great deal more. But you know your collection inside out. But sometimes you actually discover new things within yes. your collection. What is your favorite piece of art in the collection? It's a difficult one.
It's a very difficult one.
Your current favorite?
I try very hard not to go there. Don't forget, I've taken an interest not only in good works of art, mm-hmm. but even in bric-a-brac, because it's part of us. And as I keep telling people, I hate showing off. This is not about showing off. The Casa Rocca is about us, Maltese people. And I always say we are all related to each other somehow or mm-hmm. other. I'm sure the Conte married the Corca, and the judge married the, I don't know, the maid or something. And we are all related somehow.
Absolutely.
And it's silly to start, you know, saying, oh, because this is showing off. People did show off. People did dress. They dressed for the festa. Mm-hmm. Look at our churches. They're so stunning. Within our house, we have some show-off items, too. Of course we have. You know, we have some beautiful lace. We have some lovely bits of silver. And even among the pictures, the portraits, I love the interpretation of portraits. Mm-hmm. They're all giving us hints about how wonderful they are sometimes. Not too much humility. Although, we have one Favre picture which does depict humility. We have one probably member of the family. She was not a Depiro, she was something else. So, you know who she was, but she obviously made a weda.
Mm-hmm. A vow.
A vow, and it came through. So she's all in black. She's not wearing any jewelry.
Mm,
the saint she is with, whom she prayed through, is dying mm-hmm. and looks miserable. Mm. The whole scene is miserable. And that was her offering. And, you know, that is one of my favorite pictures, in fact, because it's telling a story. On the other hand, pretension can be fun.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a lovely picture by Zara, which I'm particularly fond of. And it's this woman, and she's trying to tell us, you know, that she is who she is, mm-hmm. sort of thing. And I always tell people, she's not old at all. She's got poudre de riz, rice powder, in her hair, because after the Perellos period, when everything was, the wigs were black, Pinto's putting white powder over it, the French.
So we're looking at early to mid-18th
yes,
century.
Yes, uh-huh. It's all coming in, and the Maltese people followed fashion, mm-hmm. You know, and you can see, and there are a lot of survivors, you know, mm-hmm. of portraiture. I have put together a book on portraiture, mm-hmm. and not just looking for quality, but just looking for subject matter.
In fact, we'll get to it as well.
Yes, yeah. You know, it is wonderful to see how much there is. I'd like future museum curators, if I may say this quite mm-hmm. humbly, I'm not blaming anybody, mm-hmm. but they haven't looked enough at the naive, mm-hmm. and we have naive treasures here, which should be included among the great works of art which we have in our museums.
Mm-hmm. They have documentary value.
Yes.
Because they're really showing very explicitly what people were wearing, how people looked, and yeah. to a certain extent they're not embellishing or beautifying them or sort of editing yeah. out the horrible bits.
The Americans, more than us, have understood naive art mm-hmm. because they didn't have too much sophisticated art. And some of their most naive art has actually become very, very valuable.
You've inherited an incredible archive of family papers, which reach back to at least the 17th century. What do these documents reveal about your family history?
Well, we are lucky that it survived. So many archives have been dismantled, even thrown away sometimes, keep one or two things which look good. But we've got a large family archive, and it goes right back. And, you know, it tells us so much of unwritten history. We've got letters. We've got 600 or so letters written by one member of the family who married in the late 1600s and went into the 1700s. He became procurator of wheat. The Grand Master gave him a lot of responsibilities. He was ennobled twice by the Grand Master and by the King of Spain. He became a lawyer in two different types of law, canon law and civil law. So he knew what he was doing. His letters are charming. In the first letter or two, he ends it by saying that he's making a bow to the Grand Master. And obviously somebody corrected him. And, you know, an inchino is not enough. You have to go even further down than that. And
touch your forehead to the ground.
Yeah. Anyway, and these things amuse me because I love microhistory, mm-hmm. the things which some people think are unimportant, I find to be very important. But going through letters, we found something which was very special. This same person.
This is Gio Pio.
He had a daughter. And he married her off to a very nice Sicilian. Obviously, she wasn't allowed to meet anybody. Mm-hmm. So it was her father's job to get an agent to find out who would make a good husband for her, who maybe was going to inherit something or had something already. Anyway, to cut a long story short, she marries a Sicilian from the family of De Ribera. And she dies of childbirth. Mm-hmm. And her husband died a year later. There was this child in Sicily, and Gio Pio had given a big dowry to her, and the family of the husband wanted to keep the child, and he said, no, I'm going to bring her up. And so he wins the tussle, mm-hmm. and the child comes to Malta, and she's growing up, and he's very fond of his grandchild. And when she comes to marriageable age, mm-hmm. he sends out his agents to find a good husband for her. And again from Sicily, a husband is found, a possible one. And he says, tell them what the daughter is going to be.
The dowry.
The dowry. Mm-hmm. And they accept. And they said, can he come and see her? And so they sent him to Malta. And he comes. And he is received by all the family, and he meets the girl, and he then writes a letter to his father and mother in Sicily, and that letter was so pleasing to the father and mother in Sicily that they sent it back to this girl's grandpa so that they could see what he had told them.
And it's in your collection.
And in it he says, "She is everything my heart could wish for. She blushes easily and she keeps her eyes low." And that is one of my prize pieces in the whole collection.
Of course.
And it's a Maltese story, which perhaps hasn't been told before.
Maltese and international, and yeah. it documents emotion.
And
which
there's
is
still
so
much more to find. Because sure. We haven't been through it all.
In fact, I was going to ask you, have you read everything in your archive?
No way. There's a lot
there.
There's
a lot more.
I mean, just imagine this chap. I have 600 of his letters alone. And then there are archives about him and his estates and who he's dealt with and who he's rented
amazing.
To and who he's spoken to and his wife. Yes. There was a sweet letter we found too. There was this husband he went off on a visit somewhere, and his wife writes to him and she says, "Our daughter is fine. Don't buy her any shoes because we've got things for her. It's all been made by the nuns. And don't worry too much about bringing me presents." She said, "If you want to have an heir, you had better come back soon."
It's remarkable.
These are incredible letters.
And where do you find this sort of very personal communication?
We've had some young people at university doing theses. Mm-hmm. Their theses are sometimes looking for unusual items. Mm-hmm. And that's what I can often provide there.
But the archive has been digitized as well.
They've done a lovely job, but they've stopped quite a long way back into the, I think, early 1800s. Mm-hmm. They haven't moved on, and there's so much more, you mm-hmm. know, of the family in the later 1800s and into the 90s. My grandfather was in the siege of Ladysmith. He was president of the Senate. There's all that Stricklandiana and all that. A lot of that hasn't been digitized.
So it's almost a complete run-through of family history, through documents, through the archives, covering at least four centuries.
Yes.
That's remarkable.
Yes.
And are these archives matched up with images, especially of the earlier ancestors, of the 16th, 17th century?
Our earliest one, is the father of Gio Pio, Lorenzo Ubaldesco.
That's remarkable.
And that's the 1600s.
Remarkable.
He's the one who married, lost his wife, became a priest, and became archdeacon of the cathedral.
He did it all.
They used to call him Oculus Episcopus, the eye of the bishop. And he used to tell the Grand Master what's going on.
The spy.
Yes.
This seems like a good place to take a break. This episode, originally recorded for the Treasures from Malta podcast series and now being broadcast on Campus FM, is a conversation between me, Francesca Balzan, and my guest, art collector Marquis Nicholas De Piro. And we're back. Pictures and links are on the podcast section at www.patrimonio.org. And don't forget to give us a follow on the Treasures from Malta podcast pages on Facebook and Instagram. Nicholas, in the absence of a national portrait gallery, you took it upon yourself to prepare a publication that is called the National Portrait Gallery of Malta, in which people from all periods and all walks of life were included. What got you to embark on this project?
Well, having tried to see who painted Malta in the first place, I felt it was important to have a book about Maltese people, about Maltese faces. Mm-hmm. Not so much about anything biographical, what they did, but why did they get themselves painted anyway? Who painted them? Who were they? Do we have any paintings of unimportant people? Mm-hmm. Important ones are very easy to find, usually. But what about the unimportant ones? Do we have any funny ones? Do we have any really badly painted ones? Do we have any wonderful ones? Do we have any masterpieces? And I said, I'll put them together as a collection. And I started going from house to house, looking at sometimes the lesser pictures, and we put, well over 1,000 together. And I think you've got a good cross-section in that book of...
the Maltese physiognomy,
yes,
in a way.
Yes, I mean, yeah. It can be a stepping stone to another book one day, because it lacks a certain amount of maybe biography. In most cases, I identified who they were, but there are still a lot of pictures of unidentified people which could be added to another book. But
how,
it was
how
great
did you know they were Maltese?
Well, I mean, I went to sort of Maltese houses, and then they all say L'Antenat, and...
You just lacked a name.
Yes, and sometimes, by the way they're dressed, you can see especially the ladies, with the wimple and that sort of thing. And then we went into the 19th century, it wasn't too difficult. A lot of people got painted, Victorian portraits, people like Testaverata's and... Iguanuses and all, and the Iguanuses. We got a lot anyway.
Those are noble people families, also patrons of,
yes,
of churches.
Yes, and business people. Yeah. There were the business communities. There were some very wealthy people in the villages of Zebbuj and Zabar and all. And sometimes church sacristies where some person who gave a donation to the church, and then they put the portrait up in the sacristy, and it was great fun doing it.
A real discovery, but also contemporary faces. I mean, I remember you asking me to include my portrait. Talking about people, let's hear a reading from your poem, Dinner at Gilero.
Dinner at Gilero's. The De Piros liked spaghetti, the Magris ravioli, the Dublesins timpana, the Coleros cannelloni. They savored an aperitif, delighted in good wine, each toasted one another and settled down to dine. They liked the view, the calma, they praised the cook as well, they spoke of politicians and all started to yell. Georgina, on her parapet, could almost hear the din, and Count Preziosi, walking past, waved with his next of kin. Ercilia heard the chatter from a nearby spot. She'd soon pass on the gossip, embellishing the lot. The choice of today was dentici, or trill, or fried lampuca, and fresh chbeinit to follow, soufflé, coffee, and sambuca. Whoever's turn, he paid the bill. They kissed and left quite late, and said 10 times as they went out, next Thursday then at 8.
Is your poetry and prose rooted in reality? I mean, are those families you mentioned real? Did these stories really happen?
That's a very difficult question. I'm slightly frightened of sincerity. I think if you write poetry, you're painting a picture. You're not showing your heart too much. It's things which struck you. In the case of the Gilero, that's as real could be, I know.
So who were the people?
I mentioned my parents, who lived at St. Paul's Bay and spent the summer there. I mentioned Eduardo Magri, who was a judge, and his wife, and they were a good source of chit-chat for my parents. They loved discussing people. Then there was Chevalier Johnny Dublesin. Now, Dublesin knew everything that was going on in the clergy. He was the bishop's right-hand man. He was the administrator of the estates. He was very fond of my father, because he and my father together had helped to organize when Gonzi was taking possession of being the bishop in Imdina. They had to organize a lot of what happened. They had to find the mule it had to be a virgin mule, which he was which carried the bishop, and then who was going to hold the reins, and who was going to hold the baldachin. So he got to know, and Dublezin was a great gossip and character, you know, and his wife was the same. Then there was Carmelo Colero. He was the CGMO, and he was, you know, chief government medical officer, and again, very much part of that clique.
Mm-hmm.
They used to meet for these meals. Then I mentioned Rosie, who was the cook at the Galero, and she was married to the. Her husband was the fisherman, and he would have caught the fish, which she cooked. And then opposite the road, and she could probably hear what was going on at the Galero, was the terrazzine of Georgina De Giorgio. And that was a source of gossip knowledge for all of St. Paul's Bay. They used to go, my parents didn't remember, people on her terrazzine listening to the latest news, which she got before anybody else. And then there was Gigi Preziosi, who was Count Preziosi, who lived up the road, and he would have been having a little stroll, coming down with his wife and maybe some of the children or something, and he would, you know, wave to them at the Galero and wave to the parapet.
And we can actually picture it because the house still survives of the Preziosi, yes, just opposite Galero.
And then there is Ercilia Vassallo. May she rest in peace. She's probably gone a long time ago. But I mean, she was, you know, again, another great source of gossip.
So do you remember all these people?
I remember them really well. Ercilia was not too welcome on the parapet, I remember. They waved to each other, but there was a certain distance.
I see.
One knew all these things, one felt them. Why was I on the parapet as a little boy? Because sometimes my parents used to say, we're going out for a walk, come. And then I was told, now sit down in that corner there and don't say a word. And I would be listening to, you know, what was going on and hearing all the gossip.
Can you picture them now?
Very, very easily.
Can you picture their faces?
Yes.
And you must have been, what, 5, 6, 7 years
old?
Yes,
that sort of age. But
so your impressions were formed then?
Yeah.
And somehow distilled into a poem so much later?
Yes.
How did you get into poetry in the first place?
Think. Well, I don't know, really. I think writing some funny things, you know, silly things for a birthday or something. And someone said, you know, it's probably through compliments. But then I didn't realize how bad I was at that thing.
The adjectives, that was the sticking point.
And then when I went to England, I had, you know, I was doing a bit of writing too. I produced a book called Lost Letters, my first book, which I didn't write completely on my own. It was a history of letters. Well, it was meant to be letters that were written,
mm-hmm,
connected with Malta,
but
which had been lost.
Uh-huh.
And so they're all fiction,
mm-hmm,
except for about 3 or 4, which feel like fiction, but are not.
Actually,
I've done a PS at the end to say which is true and which is not. And I met this publisher in England, and he liked the idea I was doing, playing about. And he said, listen, why don't we do a book? And I said, yeah. I said, but I'm not writing all of it. And I knew some quite intellectual people. Mm-hmm. I mean, I went to Professor Colero. He was a historian in Malta. I said, can you do a Roman period? I said, something, invent something, somebody. No, I said, I don't write fiction. I said, I know you don't, but I think you can if you want to. And I asked a few historians, and they went along with it.
Fantastic. And so you edited it.
The only version of their fictions. And we found situations. Like, for example, you know, when Publius came,
mm-hmm,
and why didn't St. Paul write a letter to Malta? He wrote to everybody he went to. Why didn't he write to Malta?
That went missing.
And so I was going to do a letter from St. Paul, and I said, no, let's make it a bit more real. St. Paul came to Malta, and there was Publius.
Mm-hmm.
And Publius received it very well, and he cured Publius's father. And now, after I don't know how long, 3 months or whatever it was, he's leaving. St. Paul is leaving.
Mm-hmm.
And Publius says, look, there's my aunt in Naples. Go and see her. And so St. Paul goes there. And then after he leaves her, the aunt writes to Publius, and that's the letter we do. And she describes Paul, and she's telling him, he's very charming, but didn't our God serve us quite well? Why are you all changing? You know, I don't know if we've ever seen the book on.
Fiction based in 60 AD.
Yes, it was great fun, that letter. And I had taken it to the monks near where I lived. There was some very clear. And I said, just see if I made some terrible mistakes. And he said, yes, he said, you've got a mistake. He said, you refer to Christians. He said, nobody would have known that. Mm. He said, you know, you've got to say this new sect of, coming from. And I put that right. Mm-hmm. And then I've had very complimentary letters, including from Monsignor Colero.
So are you presently working on any books that we can look forward to?
I am, and it's a book which I will not have written myself, but I'm working hard on it. About 3 years before my father died, my father was a great raconteur. Mm. He could tell a story, you'd be laughing halfway through it before the punchline came, because he did it well. And I once said, Dad, you've got so many stories, put them down for me. And his eyes rose, I remember. He said, look, I'm not writing a biography or something. I said, no. I said, stories, things you came across in the past. I said, if there was a crazy aunt, and everybody has crazy aunts somewhere, I said, don't be afraid, because this is not for publication. I said, tell the truth, just what really happened. And he had an old typewriter, an Imperial, I think it was called, mm-hmm. two fingers, you know, and he used to type a lot. When he died, he had written quite a lot. And they were all tucked away in the archives. Mm-hmm. And I said, now, with this COVID business, mm-hmm. I'm going to go through them. And I thought they were quite interesting. Mm-hmm. Yes, I mean, they start off when he was born. Things he was told about when mm-hmm. he was born.
Of course.
You know, in Hattart. And then a little bit later, he's about 3 or 4 years old, they're all in Birzebuja. And he says Birzebuja was a little place, not many people there. There were mm-hmm. two or three villas. And he said there were the Preziosis or somebody, or the this or the that. We used to have tea with each other. He said,
during summer, presumably, because it is a seaside town.
Said, we rented a house. There was no electricity. There was no water. We had to use the well. And no telephone, of course. And we're talking 1917. And he said, people knocked on the door to sell us food. Mm-hmm. And he said, the gabelotti, they called them. They used to come.
Yeah.
And he said, then they also to entertain us. And he describes an entertainment. How somebody came, knocked on the door. And she would dance and she would sing. And they used to tease her and they used to say, Tafsha Haja Bringlish Eva, anche Italian, and she would invent all the words.
In English and Italian, so they would provoke
and
her to try.
And he remembered some of the words, and he put them down. And I've now done, I've got to page 100 mm-hmm. typing, and he's not yet married. Among my father's stories, there are items which are perhaps amusing today. There was a get-together of families at Birzebuja. My father was a little boy, he was about 5 or 6, and he tells the story about his uncle, the Monsignor Upper Bologna. They were having tea with one of the old families, looking at the boats bobbing in front of them, and somebody said, Semuru in Reishu, Naritne. We're off to do a little bit of fishing. They do it by hand, you know, with the Rishaim. And the Monsignor said, I would like to come. And they said, of course, you are very welcome. And the day came and he dressed up in a white suit, of course wearing his dog collar. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the Lutzu came alongside for him to go on to the Lutzu before they went out into the, and he there wasn't a proper jetty. He was 17 stone and he always looked up. He never looked down. And he was approaching, looking down a little bit. He had a big double chin and he put one foot into the lutsu and he felt it going down rather a lot. And he tried to reverse and he wasn't quite able to do it. And there was a small crowd looking around on the bay. And he was the first one because it was the Monsignor going onto the boat. And so the water started coming into the boat and he started looking a little bit concerned, but he still tried to look dignified. And slowly the boat started sinking in the water with the Monsignor, and the people around started clapping and cheering. He didn't show his face to the public for at least another week.
So I'm soon going to let you go, but not before I ask you this one. The dining table at Casa Rocca Piccola is probably one of the most beautiful and most photographed tables in Malta. Now, which figures from history would you have around that table in your ideal dinner party?
This is not easy. There are so many people I would like to talk to who are not around anymore. As we grow old, I'm approaching my 80th birthday. I suppose there are more people I knew who have gone than who are still here. But there are some people I would so much like to talk to again. I'm going back to ancestors. I'm going back to my most successful ancestor, Gio Pio, who was a man who did a lot of things. He moved around. He was coming and going in Sicily and heaven knows Naples and mixing with people and organizing ships. I would like to have a chat with him. And I hope he'd bring his wife along too. And then in later years, I would very much like my paternal grandfather, who carried me in his arms, and he died when I was 1 week away from my first birthday. Mm. So I never got to know him, and I'm handling his things all the time. All the archives were saved by him. And he was a brave man. I know that from my father. When some person was being beaten up at St. Paul's Bay, and Grandpa was already an old man, and there was a quarrel going on, Grandpa wanted to go and help him, to save him, because he thought it was unfair. And my father said we had to hold him back. He didn't know fear. He was absolutely a brave man. He was in the siege of Ladysmith in South Africa in the Boer Wars. When he came back to Malta, they put a carrozzina out for him without a horse, and all the soldiers pushed it all the way up to the palace square. There's a lovely scene there with my grandmother and the governor and all sorts of things. He's a man I'd like to know. Very humble, never showed off. He, for his birthday, his great thing was he'd bring the poor into the house and have a feast for them. That was his birthday celebration. And I found some old photographs of the scene, which I'm so pleased, which will be going into this book I'm working on.
Nicholas, thank you for your time. This has been wonderful, just reminiscing with you and looking at the past. You have been so incredibly generous with different generations of historians and art historians. You've opened your home up to the public and you've shared your stories, your family history, the artifacts you collected. And for that, we are all extremely grateful. Thank you, Nicholas.
I'd like you to know I'm blushing.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Treasures from Malta on Campus FM. This was originally recorded as a podcast, and there are pictures and links to all we've discussed on the Fondazione Patrimonio Malti website under the podcast section. That's www.patrimonio.org.